Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast.
Hi, this is AJ Kelton. I'm joined for a conversation today with the Assistant Director of Learning Design at the John A. Dutton E-Education Institute at Penn State University, Stevie Rocco. Thanks for joining us today.
No problem.
So let's get right into it. What are the most important parameters when assessing the readiness of students to move into an online course?
Well, there are a bunch of things, in my opinion. First is that the self-motivation is really key, because without having a time and place set for learning, many online courses are not synchronous. They're asynchronous courses. Students really need to be motivated enough to set aside some time to get in there and actually do the work. That self-motivation and that preparedness to take responsibility for their own learning and to really kind of take a look at the syllabus, see what they need to do, ask questions when they need to. It's not something where you can just sit there and have it fed to you. Right. You need to take some action. There are some really good surveys about, you know, student readiness. I would encourage students and institutions to offer those before students register so that they are sure that they're prepared.
What role do you see social media playing in teaching and learning?
Oh, social media is huge. So I see two roles for it. One is for in the online space and one in the resident space. In the resident space, I think it really does well to increase engagement. You have a large lecture class, for example, 500 students, 1,000 students. Students who sit in the back will never raise their hand and ask a question. But if you have a hashtag and a Twitter stream and you can have someone monitoring that, that gives those students an opportunity to have a voice, to ask questions, and to participate in the class without putting themselves out there the way they might not be comfortable doing. In addition, it allows students, you know, today everybody's connected all the time with everything. We all have our phones, we have our iPads, we have our laptops. It allows them to offer extra resources. So the faculty member might be talking about something and they could post a link to a picture about, you know, the national parks, or here's another example of that type of geology, or, you know, whatever. So I really see it as increasing engagement in a residential setting. Similar in an online setting, but slightly different. Online settings I would see probably being as slightly more asynchronous. I think you could still use Twitter for that. But there are other tools like Piazza, Yammer, Facebook, where students can self-organize around studying for tests or figuring out concepts. And I think it's really important for faculty members to set the tone in those spaces so that they don't just become free-for-alls where students answer, you know, here's the homework, everybody can just copy this, but really spend the time to teach them how to use it to really engage on a different level.
So I want to go back just for one second to something you said about the resident space. It really seems to me as if what you're saying is that it's breaking down the walls of the classroom.
Yes, I would say that that's completely true. So, for example, there was a class that was taught by two faculty members at our university. They used Twitter in that class, and the students, I will be honest, they hated it for the first 2 or 3 weeks. But by the end of each semester that they've used it, students really felt closer to the students in that class than anybody else. In addition, because there were several of us outside of the class that knew the hashtag, we would follow that hashtag during class. And so while the students in the class were tweeting and having information and input and, you know, having a conversation, outside of the class, we were all participating as well and saying, oh, you should mention this link, or here's something else you might want to think about. And so the conversation became broader than just the classroom itself.
That's so cool. That brings me to another question that I had in regard to that. And when bringing social media into teaching learning, how do you bring into it also the issue of privacy?
Yeah, privacy is huge and it's important. And I'll be frank, we don't do that very well with people yet. So I think, you know, it's really important to be proactive and to educate as far as privacy concerns. You know, people can have protected tweets, but then their tweets don't necessarily show up in the hashtag stream. So understanding sort of the limits of that, or maybe suggesting that people have accounts that they just use for these professional purposes. Even today, we run into students who are nervous about doing a blog post in public.
Right.
When in fact, what we're trying to do is to encourage them to build this portfolio of information where they can show a prospective employer someday that they've really thought about a particular topic, and here's how their thought process has gone, and you can kind of follow that through a blog. We still have students who are nervous about that. So I think it's a matter of education and just sort of working with people where they are.
Yeah, there's this assumption on the student part that anything that's public-facing needs to be so polished and finely tuned, because otherwise it reflects poorly, not on the fact that they're constructing knowledge.
Exactly.
This, right, moves us from the banking method right into a constructivist method.
Exactly. So it moves us into a space where students are, you know, don't get it right, get it written. You can go back and polish it a little bit later, but it doesn't have to be perfect. Now, it should be thoughtful, and it should show that you've been thinking about a topic. But beyond that, you know, in your basic spell check, which most systems will have, right? But beyond that, it doesn't really have to be a perfect research paper. You know, I have the biggest problem with students that write blog posts that are nothing but citations.
Right.
You know, and it's all citation. I want to know what they think. And yeah, cite if you use something, but it doesn't have to be overwhelmingly research-based.
So you had said earlier that it's up to the faculty member to set the tone. I think that's really very important. What do you think are the most important things for the instructors to anticipate about their students' needs when designing online courses?
When you're looking at an online course, it's a completely different game. One of the first things that I say to faculty members is that you really need to manage expectations. Students will be fine with almost anything that you do as long as they know up front. They're going to be fine with you being away at a conference for 3 or 4 days, but send them an email ahead of time saying, I'm going to be offline for 3 or 4 days. And letting them know when they can expect to hear from you. So, you know, they need to know that you're not on 24/7, that you are only going to check your email once on a weekend. And especially important for adult learners who may be serving in the military or be, you know, kind of have to have business trips and those sorts of things. Those students really appreciate kind of knowing what the ground rules are. The other thing that I try to emphasize with them is to just make sure that you're really, really clear. Because there's not that face-to-face component, if you're even slightly off, students can't walk up to you after class and ask you. They're going to send you an email. And if you have a class of 50 or 100 students and you get 20 emails with the same question, mm-hmm. you know you weren't clear enough.
Right.
So I generally recommend that they keep a Google Doc or some kind of a document the first time they offer an online course. Just keep track of all of those things. Don't worry about fixing them right then, but just keep track of them. And that way, when you're ready to do it again, you have a – because you'll forget by the end of the semester, right?
Sure.
I mean, but by the next time you offer it, then you can have that list and you know what you need to focus on.
That's an excellent piece of advice. You know, this is very interesting because you brought up military, you brought up a collection of different types of students. What kind of technology challenges are we looking at risk first-generation students who are experiencing online perhaps in a limited way and maybe for the first time, really? And how do we address these?
Yeah, first, I think it's probably it's a little bit of an assumption for us to assume that students come to higher education not having had an online experience. A great number of students, I remember there were conversations years ago about should we allow freshmen to take online courses. Well, the fact of the matter is we have a large percentage of our students who come in who have already taken online courses in high school. So there's that piece of it. But with at-risk students, yeah, there are going to be technology challenges with those students. And I think the best thing that we can do is try to scaffold their learning, offer them resources, pair them up with other people, do all kinds of things to sort of help to support them and scaffold them up to the place where we need them to be technologically. The other challenges are, of course, the fact that, you know, you can't guarantee what someone's going to have experience with. You don't know if they're going to be on a Mac or a PC or if they have a smartphone or if they don't have a phone at all. Just that lack of knowledge makes the design of it more difficult, but it makes it ever more important that you just sort of help to support those students where there might be an issue with technology.
So what direction do you see learning design moving as we move into the future?
I think with the new technologies and the ways that teaching and learning and pedagogy are changing are really going to change the game. In the past, I think there was a lot of model of the faculty member gets paired with an instructional designer. The instructional designer takes their material. They help to make them better. They help them to do the pedagogy. They help them write objectives, and then they put it online for them. But that really puts the designer in between the faculty member and the students in some ways. I think we're moving to a place where our job is more to teach people how to fish. So in working through the design of the course, we show them how do you write a good objective. We show them how do you edit your own material. How do you add activities? And we get faculty members really thinking through those concepts using our resources in knowing the educational technology and all of the other things that are out there and coming down the pike. That's the value add. And then helping them to get comfortable enough to really make it their own course.
Excellent. So that was a bit of an emphasis on the instructor. What advice would you give an institution that's just starting out in the e-learning area?
It's got to be thought through carefully. And a lot of ways, it really depends on the institution. I remember having a conversation. Penn State is, we have a board of trustees. We have 22 campuses. But if you graduate from Penn State, you graduate from Penn State. Other institutions, you graduate from the particular campus that you came from. So you graduate from UW-Madison, or you graduate from SUNY New Paltz, or right? So you graduate from, because of the governance structures of the institution, I really think you have to be careful about how you structure your e-learning. And the way the governance structure of an institution is going to kind of depend on how you might roll it out. So it makes it easier or harder to collaborate across campuses if you're a larger institution. If you're a smaller institution, resourcing is generally an issue. But I think the advent of open source technologies and having people who really can help folks get themselves up to speed would really help in that arena. But I just think it's really got to be thoughtful.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's say you're asked to come in and advise an institution, because I think the Penn State system is unique. Let's say that you were asked to go in and provide advice to an individual institution on how to craft an e-learning strategy.
Right.
What would you say?
I would say that there's a lot of pieces to that. That you need to have the right people around the table. So you need to have the people that are dealing with registration, finance, student services, as well as the design folks, because, you know, it's not just about the design. It's also about the delivery and student support. Who is your audience? How large geographically are you trying to pinpoint folks? How are you going to make this happen? How's the money going to flow? How do you incentivize people to participate if they're not really sure about this? And what support services are you willing to put in place, and how are you going to pay for them? So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of pieces, and you have to kind of tackle all of them with the right players around the table. So I think the first thing that I would do is to sort of help them to gather those people together and then really talk about what's your situation and what's your system and what might work for you.
That's great. Thank you so much for your time today. We've talked about a lot of different things here, and they're all, right, sort of moving parts, right?
Right.
Is there anything that you'd like to add?
I don't think so. I think it's really an exciting time for us right now, and I'm really looking forward to moving forward. I'm looking forward to, like, interinstitutional cooperation happening more easily, things like that. So I think it's going to be great.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.